The following Dharma talk was recorded in March 2014 in St. Louis, Missouri. It is one of eight recordings from the retreat called Suffering and the End of Suffering, taught by Bridget Rollins and John Yaffe. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. Bridget Rollins has practiced insight meditation since 1997. Recognized by the Spirit Rock Teachers Council as a community Dharma leader, Bridget co-leads the St. Louis Insight Meditation Group, teaches classes, and leads retreats. John Yaffe began practicing insight meditation in 1999 and has been co-leader of St. Louis Insight Meditation Group since 2006. He has served on the board of directors of Mid-America Dharma since 2005 and currently serves as its president. More information about Bridget and John can be found at www.dharmastl.org.
I want to begin the second Dharma talk. We'll be ultimately discussing the second noble truth, but I want to begin by creating kind of a bridge between the first noble truth and the second noble truth, kind of focused on that sankhara dukkha, that suffering that arises from the proliferation of mental formations. There was one of these science shows on TV many years ago that just fascinated me. They were teaching that you could take you could take cornstarch, and if you dissolved a great deal of it in water, the water became, I guess it was right on a borderline between what chemists call a sol and a gel. So it could behave either as a fluid or as a solid. And the thing that differentiated between the two states was how you touched it, as if with your awareness. So if you touched it with a lot of impact, it behaved like a solid. And if you touched it gently or were still, as you were up against it, it behaved as a liquid. So these scientists/entertainers who were putting together this show acquired 3 tons of cornstarch and poured it into a swimming pool and stirred it up and created an entire pool filled with a slurry. And then they had all their tech guys, they didn't want to do it themselves, but their roadies, they had them run across the surface of the swimming pool. And as long as they would slap their feet down, they would be on top of the surface of it. So they could stand, they were walking on water. But in order to do that, they had to constantly be moving and slapping with their feet. They couldn't rest for an instant. And the minute they became still, they would sink into it because it became a liquid. It struck me that this is the way our mind behaves. We have minds that are convinced that in order to stay above the surface of it all, to keep from falling into something and drowning, the mind needs to stay constantly active. Not just the storyline of mental proliferation, but the process of it. We do it in order to sustain ourselves. An unpleasant thought arises, or an unpleasant event occurs, the conflict at work, the pain in the knee, and rather than be still with it, which would allow us to get to the truth of it, which is to say that it might just be a passing momentary thing, instead of allowing that stillness to allow us to sink into the truth of what it is and allow that truth to really manifest, we stay active. We get busy. We keep it going. We just keep it rolling. So this is part of the underlying mechanism of why we sustain dukkha, why we create this for ourselves. Why do we do it? We get caught in ignorance with the fundamental misperception of the nature of reality. The developing mind evolves the ability to create the idea of object constancy, but it's a fragile idea because, in fact, it's not true. It's a very useful functionality. It's helpful to be able to think, and it's helpful to be able to predict and work with thoughts about the future. But in fact, if we're honest about it and are still with it, we realize we don't know what the future will be. And even if the storyline we roll out about how the future will unfold turns out to be accurate, it's still a mental proliferation, because many things can be true at the same time. So you can look at the world and think it's the best of all places. You can look at the world and think it's the worst of all places, and you'll be right. James Branch Cabell, one of my favorite early 1900s writer, coined a definition of optimist and pessimist. He said, the optimist believes he lives in the best of all possible worlds, and the pessimist is afraid he's right. So it's not the issue. Any truth that we can grasp with this mind is going to be a partial truth. One of the finest things the Buddha said is, whatever we take something to be, that it is not. Not because we're necessarily wrong in seeing something some way, but we're wrong if we think that things are only one way. So let's move on to the second noble truth, the noble truth of the origin of dukkha, the origin of suffering. I have a note here to ascribe this talk to Ajahn Sumedho. I wrote this some time ago. I've filigreed it out over a period of years, but he apparently was at the heart of it to begin with. So he's the guy I took it from. But he took it from someone else, I'm sure. What is the noble truth of the origin of suffering? Says the Buddha. It is the craving which renews being and is accompanied by relish and lust. Now, we don't talk about relish much without thinking about sweet pickle relish. He's not talking about that. So just to be clear. It is the craving which renews being and is accompanied by relish and lust. We like it. Relishing this and that. In other words, craving for sensual desires. Craving for being. Craving for non-being. But whereon does this craving arise and flourish? Wherever there is what seems lovable and gratifying, thereon it arises and flourishes. There's a lot in this. The idea of renewing being, what does he mean by that? A lot of that has to do with renewing the sense of self. We'll come to that. But the sense of self is, if the underlying experiences that fill our awareness are impermanent, how do we take a progression of things which are impermanent and out of that craft an image that says, not only are things permanent, but I'm permanent as the observer of those things? It's very interesting. He's saying craving is the tool, if you will, by which that sense of being is renewed. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? It just is. But we have the ability to react to it however we like. The second noble truth states that there is an origin of suffering, and that the origin of suffering is attachment to desire. Not desire in and of itself. Not the feeling tone that says this is pleasurable, not even the desiring of that which is pleasurable, but the fact that we grow attached to it. Attachment to desire, of which, like suffering, there are three kinds. The Buddha liked threes. Actually, he liked lists, but a lot of them had three things in it. So we hear in that definition I just read, there's desire for sense pleasure. There is desire to become, to have, to hold, to be, and the desire to be rid of, to non-become. So the root in all of that, the desire word in Pali, is tanha. It's translated as thirst. You think of when is the time you've been most thirsty in your life, when the idea of thirst has shouted out every other desire that you've ever had because you were really, really thirsty. Have you ever been there? Tanha, thirst. So there's kama, tanha, the desire for sense pleasures, bhava, tanha, the desire for becoming, and vibhava, tanha, the desire for non-becoming or to be rid of. This is what you contemplate. The origin of suffering is attachment to desires. Let's look at these different types or facets of desire. Kama tanha, the desire for sense pleasure, is pretty easy to understand. It's analogous to understanding dukkha dukkha, the dukkha of pain. We tend to get direct sensory experience as much as we get anything. This kind of desire is seeking pleasure through the body's senses, always seeking things to excite or please your senses. Note that to the Buddha, the mind is one more sense organ. So in the Buddhist realm of psychology, they talk about there being six senses. Sight, sound, touch, taste, smell, and the mind's operating, awareness itself. So we can desire mental states. We can be aware of our mental formations much as we are aware of bodily sensations. You should be aware that what we find pleasing can be indirect as well as direct, because that will confuse us if we're not. It can be secondary rather than primary, and it can even seem backwards or perverse. A simple explanation is that, as an example Matt Flickstein gives, you can think of someone watching a sunrise. You know, and if you've set aside the time to do that, if it's where you want to be, that sunrise coming up is, you know, something beautiful that gives you the spacious sense of connection to the whole universe. It's a lovely experience. Then he says, okay, over here, that's one person. Here's another person. And, he's got a term paper due or has, you know, some life limiting critical assignment due at work. Or maybe he's a prisoner about to be executed at dawn. There are situations when that same external stimulus is experienced in completely different terms. So forwards is backwards and backwards is forwards. And if you understand the context, you understand why. Is the sunset beautiful? True. Is the sunset horrifying? True. And we can crave certain types of reward out of an experience which transcends any external person's view of that experience. So you have people who are craving attention. You have children, for example, craving attention so much from a parent who's ignoring them that they will do something destructive. They'll, you know, throw down a lamp or spill something or break something on purpose, getting all kinds of negative attention, criticism, terrible messages. You're a bad kid. All stuff like that, but they're getting the attention that they want. So there can be all kinds of distortions in what we crave and in the manifestations of what we crave. This makes it difficult to work with people who get on our nerves, because a lot of times we see their actions, and from our perspective and from our broader perspective of any reasonable person's view, we say they're acting in an obnoxious way. But at some level, they're seeking fulfillment of some essential human need, just as you would. They're just finding a different means of expressing that need. It's hard to see. Because having these experiences are pleasurable, albeit perhaps in a convoluted way, we associate desire with pleasure. Now that's interesting all by itself, because if you pay attention to the experience of desire, it's not intrinsically pleasant. And yet we associate it with pleasant because it seeks the object of something to acquire. So I as I was reviewing this, I was thinking of the distortions that come out in romantic communications with people. You know, I love you so much it hurts. So of course I'm going to keep doing it. Things like that. I love you so much I don't want you to change. It's like, why don't I put you in a glass bale and just... We do some very strange things there. This association between desire and pleasure is a conditioned tendency of mind. But again, if we pay close attention to our direct experience, what we notice as the essence of the experience of desire is wanting more of something. Which is to say, it begins in the experience of not having enough. So it's actually related to the experience of insufficiency or lack. So there's an irony here. Having what we want isn't sufficient because we don't want what we have. We want more of what we have. Or we want something different from what we have. This goes back to that issue, that question I asked earlier. I think Bridget asked it before I did. Have you ever had anything satisfy you in a way that was complete and absolute? No. It's because we don't, if we continue grasping for things because we don't appreciate the deep, profound truth that no external object is going to bring us complete and lasting satisfaction. So, you know, we get something, we find it doesn't satisfy us, so we go to get more of the same thing that we already know doesn't satisfy us. Because we think that it's not the thing, it's the moreness that will bring the satisfaction. Bridget has a wonderful exercise she does time to time on Sunday nights at the yoga center. An eating exercise where she'll bring typically grapes. So everyone gets a little tiny cluster of grapes and we sit down to eat them. And we're asked to pay attention, eat them mindfully, much in the spirit of the instructions she gave before lunch. And what invariably happens is that someone will observe that they've taken a grape into their mouth. They've either begun chewing it or they're deeply into chewing it up, enjoying it, tasting all the sweetness, all the texture, hearing the crunch, crunch, crunch. And yet their attention is drawn to the grapes that they have in their hand that they haven't eaten yet. Think about that, because that's what's going on. You know, the next grape is not going to be a whole lot different than the grape that's in our mouth. And that's already there. It's already giving us what we want, and yet we're not satisfied with what we want. We want the next what we want. It's very, very interesting. If we pay still further attention, we'll see that the real goal of craving isn't to get what the craving tells us we want. The real goal is simply to get the craving to cease. It's very interesting. Don't just believe this because I'm saying it, or dismiss it because I'm saying it. Try it out. Taste something delicious and see what happens. A desire for more arises. And most of us keep eating or otherwise acquiring more until the craving dissipates, often because discomfort arises when we are stuffed and the feeling of being uncontrollably full becomes more powerful than the craving. But the thing that makes us stop eating is that the craving goes away, not the fullness. This is kama tanha. The idea of craving for becoming may not register true to us initially, especially if you haven't been exposed to that thought, or we may not even understand it really. But it's there to be seen when we learn to look. Craving is the root of and the thing that maintains the sense of self, the coming of the sense of being, becoming. How so? Let me ask you this. How often do you mindfully observe hunger is arising in this mind? That's not the languaging you use if you say it out loud. It's not the internal languaging you use in your head. Don't you more commonly think, I am getting hungry. I want dinner. I want more dessert. In order to gain or attain something from the outside, there has to be something on the inside that seeks to get satisfied or filled. Attachment and identification with craving catches us in the realm of ambition and attainment, the desire to become, and by extension, the desire to have. So the actual becoming, in a sense, comes before the having, because it is the self that gets to possess. We get caught in that movement of striving to become happy, or seeking to become wealthy, or we might attempt to make our life feel important by striving to make the world right, to have a library or hospital wing named after us. We may seek immortality of a sort through creating or funding great and enduring works. Again, if we look closely, there is a sense of insufficiency behind all of this. I won't be satisfied. There's not enough in here. I'm not a complete person unless I get some recognition, I get something, I build an edifice, something that will last after I'm gone. We may come to terms with death in one sense and yet seek a displaced kind of immortality, which again is the desire for being. Again, if we look closely, there is a sense of insufficiency. In these strivings is the wanting to become something more than what and who we are right now. And as we cultivate mindfulness of this, be on the alert for it everywhere, even in your practice. You may find yourself quietly thinking things like, I want to practice meditation so I can become free of my pain or become enlightened. I want to become enlightened, so I'd like to become a monk or a nun. We'll take on a new persona. I'll be a new person. Or I want to become enlightened as a lay person. I want to have a spouse and children and a profession too. I want to enjoy the sense world without having to give up anything. That would be nice. And become fully enlightened too. That would be extra nice. When we get disillusioned with trying to become something, or we possess or are afflicted with something we don't like, then there arises the desire to get rid of things. And that too can be a sense of self. I have the power to obliterate. You know. So we are in the grip of, or in a position to contemplate, the desire to get rid of, or the desire for non-being. I want to get rid of my suffering. I want to be rid of my anger. I want to get rid of my jealousy, fear, and anxiety. I hate you. I want you to die. I hate myself. I want to die. All of those are different expressions. I had an encounter with my inner child some time ago on a retreat. And that inner child really manifested this quality, so I'll describe this story to you. It began with me sitting and feeling as if I was suddenly tilted on one side and like my hands were hot and burning. So that caught my attention. And internally I was like, what's going on? So I said, okay, let's go into this feeling. What does it feel like? And the only feeling I could relate to was when I had been a toddler and I had been riding a tricycle and I took a corner too quick and the tricycle turned and I went into the pavement that way and burned my hands, you know, scraped my hands. So my adult observer decided I would comfort my inner child. So I said to my inner child, I was cool. I didn't want to make assumptions. So I said to my inner child, what's going on? I guess I don't really know it's an inner child, whatever it was. What's going on? And I expected him to tell me the story about him. He took a spill and he's hurt and life isn't fair and stuff like that. But that's not what he said. What he said is, I'm angry. So I said, oh, okay, I can work with this. Why are you angry? He said, I'm angry because I want everything. So I said, oh, okay, let's go with this, see where it leads. I said, so if you had everything, what then? And he said, I'm so angry, I'd break it. Everything. So I thought, well, I'm going to reason with this little fellow. So I said, so if you had everything, and if you broke it, you'd have nothing. And he said, no, I'd still have everything. It would just be broken. And that was the end of that encounter. maybe I'm reading more into it than is there, but I don't think so. I think this is that essence of that quality of the desire for non-being and the ability to see in non-being some kind of positive outcome, that I would have everything and I would have control over everything. It would be broken, but I don't care. It would still be mine and it would still be everything. And as I thought about that, well, isn't this the psychology of, these people that murdered their families and then killed themselves? Isn't that having everything? It would just be broken. Isn't there a direct lineage in that kind of process? So I literally laughed and then I cried because it was very funny. And at the same time, it was very sad, and it was recognizing that, whoa, that's in me. That's still there. I didn't, you know, even if I made it up, who made it up, you know? So, and I think that's part of the greater lesson of the fact that this practice will ultimately put you in touch with every aspect of your humanity. Because when you become still and focused, things are free to arise. You don't have to interact with them in a negative way. You can learn from them and you can perhaps help them heal. I don't know that I had a lot of healing to offer that little fella, but I let him say what he had to say, and that must have been inside me for some time. So it's very interesting, and it's helpful to become able to see all those different aspects of craving. The craving for sense pleasures, not hard to see. The craving for becoming, not hard to see, really, once you know how to look for it. The craving for non-becoming. It's easy to understand non-becoming in the sense of external destruction. I don't like you, I'll make sure I'll make you go away, or I'll take away something you want, that kind of power. But when it operates inside us, that's interesting to connect to and see. And it's liberating to see because it takes away some of our tendency to judge and condemn, brings out the sense of the need for compassion. Okay. There is a subtle but essential point to make about all three forms of craving for us to understand them correctly. All craving is simply one of a host of mental formations, simply one more impersonal set of experiences that arise in consciousness unbidden due to causes and conditions, some of which we know about, many of which we do not. Desire, if you will, is a particular type of cloud that from time to time floats across the sky of our awareness, as are the other mental formations. Desire or craving only becomes a problem when, like pain or uncertainty, it becomes drawn into mental proliferation. When we layer delusions of meaning and significance onto it and become attached to and identified with these. This is what the Buddha is getting at when he speaks of relish and lust. The relish and lust. The relish is that, you know, layering. Let's put a little something extra sweet on top of this. Maybe he is talking about pickle relish. Relish and lust, and says whatever there is that seems lovable and gratifying. Doesn't have to be pleasant. We can find something unpleasant gratifying. Hopefully I made that case. But wherever there is that seems lovable and gratifying, thereon it arises and flourishes, the tendency for these mental proliferations. What's arising and flourishing is mental proliferation, the content of which is desire. But it's really the mental proliferation which causes the problem. We build up stories for ourselves of how it's so important, even critically necessary, that we get what we want and avoid or destroy what we don't want, or must cast away those things of which we have grown tired. So the challenge of desire isn't to stifle or suppress the desire itself. That would involve aversion and creating still more layers of mental proliferation as we get busy layering up anger and pushing away on top of whatever it was that made us feel that way. Rather, the challenge is simply to recognize desire as desire and make nothing more or less out of it than what it is. What's the simple like it and want to have it, or what's the simple dislike it and want to avoid it, none of which has much drama, compared to seeing that and, wait a minute, if we can see this, we can also see where the simple arisings end and the mental proliferations building on them begin. So this is wanting, this is what I want, and this is the story about how important that wanting is. And how important I am for being the person who's doing all this important wanting, and on and on. So we need to ask ourselves, what is the quality of attention we pay to our desires? If we identify with them, get drawn into the selfing they sponsor and promote, we are giving them what the Buddha calls unwise attention. If instead we can see these as what they are, impermanent, unsatisfactory, dukkha, if you will, and impersonal, not who we are. They are simply what's arising in awareness. Then we are giving them wise attention, and we are not throwing fuel on that fire. Instead, we can observe what it feels like when craving for a desired object is present. This is what it feels like when craving for becoming is present. This is what it feels like when for craving to be rid of something is present. So we can know which of these forms of craving arises when they arise. When observed and acknowledged, but not fed with unwise attention and not indulged, desires pass, and we are free from the constant back and forth of chasing and fleeing, grabbing and pushing away. Free from the delusion that these cravings are integral and responsive to who we are. Then we can observe what it feels like when the mind is free of craving. No sense desire is present. No desire for becoming is present. And no desire to be gone or be rid of is present. This is what is meant by the expression we take from the metta practice. May I be peaceful and at ease. Let's sit for a few minutes.